All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Thank you, Tina. As you all know, Justice Abrahamson is on the phone, so I won't bother to go through that with you again. I know our marshal has already done that. So we'll begin by calling our first case, State versus Reed. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Joe Eman, representing Faith Reed. We have a tiny misdemeanor case today that has the potential to recast the ease with which the government can gain access to all of our homes. Ms. Reed's kind of a peripheral character in this today. Center stage is the interaction between Officer Keller, Tacoma Police Officer Keller, and Kirk Sullivan, whom Keller encountered on the street outside Sullivan and Reed's apartment, as Keller and what I'm guessing is a significant percentage of the Tacoma police force descended on the area to investigate an altercation, a reported altercation that turned out to be a verbal argument between two siblings.
Counsel, you'd help me immensely if you'd speak into the microphone.
Sure, all right.
Yeah. And slowly.
Maybe.
Thank you.
Elevate it a little. Or maybe not.
All right. The central issue today is whether from Keller's encounter with Sullivan, there developed constitutional consent or exigency to justify a warrantless entry into Ms. Reed's home 9.5 minutes later. This case is somewhat unusual in that there was a body cam recording of everything that happened. The facts, as the trial court said, come from the video. Therefore, there wasn't many factual findings by the trial court.
But to the extent there were factual findings, are you asking us to overturn those findings based upon our own review? I have reviewed video.
Well, the parties agree on the historical facts of the case, who said and did what. And we disagree with a couple of the things the lower court found because the tape proves them wrong, and I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
I think the state will concede that nothing Mr. Sullivan said granted consent. Sullivan barely speaks in the entire episode. It's all Keller and Cannon and Keller talking to other cops. Keller didn't ask Sullivan to enter the apartment, and Sullivan didn't grant verbal consent.
Was the officer asked to enter the apartment building? You're not complaining that that was illegal, correct?
Oh, no, that's public area. He didn't need consent. He didn't.
Was he asked to? No. So there was no asking him to come into the public building?
No.
Was there any asking of him to come up to the floor where the apartment is located?
No, not only was there not any asking, Keller dictated to Sullivan, all right, let's go. And Keller dictated the action here.
Thank you.
The gist of the state's argument in the lower court's rulings were that Mr. Sullivan, by supposedly freely and voluntarily leading Keller to Reed's apartment, granted implied consent to enter. But that's not what happened. But Sullivan didn't lead anything and didn't control any of the action here. When Keller showed up on the scene, Cannon and Sullivan were standing on the side of the road. Keller got out of his car and said, hey, what's going on? They both approached the officer.
Counsel, instead of the long factual recitation, could you, perhaps we could cut through some of that with this. Was Mr. Reed seized at any point in that interaction?
Absolutely.
And when did that occur?
46 seconds into the into the tape. Kellers had been talking to Cannon, who I guess I would fair to say is exuberantly cooperative. He's very animated talking. And 46 seconds in, Keller notices that Sullivan, who had come forward but didn't say a word, was just standing by silently, had left. He walked away. 46 seconds in, Keller yells, "Hey, why don't you come back here? Don't just leave." Sullivan stops, walks approximately 15 steps back. When he gets back, Keller says, "Keep your hands out of your pockets for me, okay?" And he does that, shows him his hands. So he's standing there, well, his hands aren't that high.
Okay. Here. And was that a Terry seizure?
That is a seizure. I don't think any reasonable person would feel free that they could ignore the police command at that point. And I think, the circuit court's sort of discussion of this, which is a legal finding, that because he wasn't, it's pretty obvious the officer wasn't ordering him back. He was not a suspect, therefore I don't think that placed him under any particular compulsion to return, is just wrong.
What do you think would have happened if he had not come back?
I think he would have been freely and voluntarily escorted to the pavement. I think it's fairly obvious that that's what would have happened. Or he could reasonably expect that's what would have happened.
But it isn't uncommon for law enforcement to encounter a situation, drive up, try to figure out what's going on. People are coming up and telling you what's going on. And instead of letting just everyone disperse, sort of get a handle of
that's right. This is a lawful seizure. The police have a right to freeze the situation, to sort out what's going on. And that's what happened. This was a lawful seizure. Absolutely.
All right. So let's say this is a seizure. How does that color the way that we look at the physical behavior from that point forward?
The fact that it's a seizure isn't dispositive in any way. A seized person can still give voluntary consent, but it informs what happens next. The police officer dictates, sort of commands Sullivan's movements throughout this. 4 minutes in, when Sullivan indicates that he wants to go watch the game, Keller says, "Now you're going to stick around for a moment until we get everything sorted out." 3 minutes later, after the only point where Sullivan really talks, and I'll get to that in a minute, 3 minutes later at 7:48, Keller says to Sullivan, "All right, let's go," and points. And I put screenshots of those in my reply brief about what happened. "All right, let's go," points, starts walking. Sullivan doesn't move until Keller gets to him or past him, and then he turns, and they walk together. So he's dictated the movement. "All right, let's go." And then when I get to the door, or actually before that, while they're walking, he says, "Hey, step over here with me." At that point, Sullivan moves in front for the first time. And then when they get to the door, says, "Hey, don't just go in like that." So every single physical movement that Sullivan makes is dictated by Officer Keller, who has the right to do it. He seized him. He's lawfully seized him. And so the point, or I guess the central point here, is implied constitutional consent cannot derive from police-directed or compelled movements. All Mr. Sullivan did throughout this was submit to Keller's lawful authority and follow his commands. The state's argument, I think the rulings of the lower courts, hinge on sort of the incredible notion that Sullivan should have just felt free to ignore the cop, and that him complying with the actions was somehow his free and voluntary compliance.
So from the moment they walked in to the apartment building, and actually, from the moment they were walking toward the apartment building and the initial entry, you take quarrel with the initial entry and then the second floor entry as
no,
well.
No, it's only the walking into the apartment building. It's a public space. The doors weren't locked. Keller didn't need anybody's permission or consent to go there. He could have gone up and knocked on the door.
Does it make any difference that he kind of held the door open for the law enforcement officer?
Well, he told him, "Look, let's go," and they walk, and he's off to his left. You don't see him a couple times while he's walking. He turns, and you can see him. Then he says, "Hey, get over here with me." So he's in front, and they're going to the apartment. But Sullivan didn't lead him there. He ended up in front toward the end because Keller told him to get in front.
Okay, so we shouldn't make anything of the notion that he kind of held the door open for the law enforcement officer the first two times, and then when he went into the apartment building,
there
was a little different scenario.
Yeah.
You're making nothing of that?
No, it's not an invitation. He's told we're going here. He's told to accompany him. You know, he didn't, like, hold the door and gesture him in. He opened the door, walked through. It stayed open. They walked together with Sullivan in front because he was ordered to be in front.
But, counsel, isn't Sullivan's actions when he held the door for the officer to go into the public area of the apartment building, isn't that a stark contrast compared to what Sullivan did when he reached the door of his apartment? He shut the door in the cop's face, right?
Well, that's what we say.
I watched the video.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like to me. So
right, that's right.
Isn't there some significance to the fact, though, that in one instance he held the door for the officer,
and then when they got to the apartment,
he shut it in his face?
The significance is that by getting to his door and closing it, it terminates any conceivable implied consent that may have been given before.
I think if the door had been shut, we wouldn't be here, because I don't think the state would be arguing that there was consent to enter. But the door was not closed.
It was open.
It was open. He did step inside and lessen the opening of the door, but he never shut the door.
I'm going to disagree with you in this sense.
Okay, because
right.
I watched the video,
It wasn't fully closed.
That's what I'm saying to you.
But the entry occurs when he touches the door. That breaches the threshold. The door is about an inch from closing.
Okay,
and
but
so
I was
rather,
only quarreling with your factual statement that he closed the door.
I didn't say he closed the door.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then I misunderstood you.
Are you saying that the door would have closed had the officer not put his hand there to stop
clearly.
It?
Yeah, it was... Sullivan
so
was
he attempted to close the door, but for the officer's direct action in crossing the threshold.
But for his unlawful entry in breaching the threshold by reaching...
Okay. I need to talk to you just a little bit about that, because now you've touched upon, and the state needs to know this too, the part of this case that bothers me the most is what is an officer to do? There are these people kind of milling about back to the door. He's seeing the situation. There's allegedly... an altercation that has a violent feel to it, and he gets to the door and sees these people. Is he supposed to just, I mean, what if they were reaching for a gun and going to, what's the officer supposed to think or do? Just wait and say, oh gosh,
all the officer
I
was entitled
that.
To do here is engage in a knock and talk. He had no right to go into the apartment at all. And there is no, I mean, it's troubling to me that you raise the specter of a gun. This was a verbal altercation. That was made clear to the police officers. There is no hint of any weapon or any danger here. This would be a very different situation if when he got to the door, he heard yelling inside, maybe somebody getting smacked around, because then we're talking about an exigency. But to introduce a gun in this is really troubling. Even if there was a gun inside, I mean, he has a Second Amendment right to have a gun in his home anyway, but I don't want to get off on that track.
Okay.
There's no hint that there's any kind of a weapon or any kind of danger, any kind of ongoing calamitous anything.
And a car, when law enforcement officers walk up to a car, they might encounter someone who's ready to shoot them, too. The line of duty for a law enforcement officer puts them at risk on a regular basis.
It's a dangerous job. This wasn't one of them. And I don't remember the case right now, but the U.S. Supreme Court, I think, has said a car ain't a castle. Different. You know, this isn't a car situation in the street where you're out in the public. This is somebody's home. And the way you can get into a home without a warrant, the way the government can come into our home without a warrant, is a very narrow path.
I agree with you.
Yep,
I mean, this is just an unusual scenario if you're actually looking at this video, because the law enforcement officer is outside.
I don't.
And there's this shuffling around in immediate sight. And
well, it's not.
What do you do with that?
No, he doesn't. I mean, he can't see anything until he pushes the door back open. Sullivan opens the door just wide enough to let himself in. I mean, which is a little bit of an unusual way to go in, I agree, but it further confirms that he was never offering to bring the officer inside. He was going to see if Harris wanted to talk to the cop. Harris was under no obligation to talk to the cop.
And so the officer should have let the door close. Whatever happens, happens.
The officer could have knocked.
Did Sullivan knock? Didn't Sullivan knock before he opened the door?
Yeah, he
knocked.
Okay. He knocked, let himself in, announcing he's coming, announcing maybe even he's not alone. Because, look, he doesn't know what's going on inside. His girlfriend, Faith, could be undressed, but could be something embarrassing going on inside. I mean, to jump to the conclusion that there's something nefarious, just because, you know, when he did open the door, Harris happened to be rolling a...
I'm not jumping to a conclusion. I'm just looking at the circumstances and what a reasonable person might... believe.
Right, and I don't think a reasonable person here could believe that there was any violent activity, any weapon, anything like that. There was a verbal argument over shoes that happened outside. It was clearly over. There wasn't any sound coming from the apartment to suggest that there was a fight or any danger. So anyway, returning to the so warrantless entry is presumably unreasonable, unconstitutional. Two narrowly drawn, jealously guarded exceptions, right? Constitutional consent and exigency. Constitutional consent requires freely given, specific, and unequivocal involuntary consent. Freely given, specific, unequivocal, voluntary. None of those factors are present here. I'll get to that in a minute. Exigency requires imminent danger, imminent threat of harm, or imminent destruction of evidence. That's simply not the case here. And, you know, one of the things that the circuit court got in its findings or conclusions was very correct about, was right on, has to do with the danger thing you're talking about. He said, there was nothing about this incident or about the individual that indicated that there was an immediate threat to the officer. I think that's true. I think that finding is accurate and entitled to deference in that regard.
To what extent does race play into this encounter in your mind?
Well, I guess, you know, I raised it in my brief in the context of, look, you know, none of us would feel free to ignore a police officer's command. I mean, you know, here, when this argument's over, Tina yells to me, "Hey, Joe, get back here, get your hands out of your pockets." I'm going to say, you know, "Tina, I got a doctor's appointment, I got to go." This gentleman with the badge and the gun does it. I'm going to miss my doctor's appointment. I mean, I wouldn't feel free to walk away. But the notion that an African-American man in America would feel free to ignore a cop when, you know, this isn't like a cop on a beat just randomly encountering people. A bunch of cop cars show this incident just happened. They're questioning about it. He leaves. Cop tells him to get back. You know, there's just no way that a person of color would reasonably feel, none of us would. It's like a race isn't determinative, but I'm just, it's emphasizing it.
And does the fact that he was on probation as well factor into that in terms of a reasonable person in his situation?
Well, yeah, he knows he better behave because, you know, if he, look, this court's decision in Young, is State versus Young a few years ago, is pretty informative on this. Young was the case where there was a cop noticed five African-American men in a car in a residential, mixed residential business area. Not doing anything wrong, no big deal. 9 minutes later, comes back. Parks turns his flashers on, not the rollers, so he's not seized at that point. Young gets out of the car, starts to walk away. Cop says, "Get back in the car." He ignores him. Cop says it again, "Get back in the car," ignores him. Cop goes after him, takes him down, roughs him up. As this court pointed out, Young had no way of knowing whether he was a suspect or not because he doesn't know what's in the cop's mind. Same is true here. And in fact, Keller found Sullivan walking away to be suspicious. He was, in effect, a suspect. And at that point, this was fairly early in the encounter, the cop didn't know their names. He just knew it was a black guy and a white guy. He didn't know Cannon, didn't know Sullivan, didn't have their addresses. He could seize him. So that's one way sort of race plays a factor in this.
But if we look strictly at the consent issue,
sure,
whether the officer had consent to enter the apartment, race is irrelevant. We don't need to go there, do we?
Oh, if well, you don't have to go to race at all. I mean, no. If there was, if Mr. Sullivan, if Officer Keller had asked, "May I come into your apartment?" and Sullivan said, "Yeah, by all means, come on in." Yeah, there's no issue here.
But also, when we look at the video again and this fact scenario, we have Sullivan entering the apartment. He attempts, and I'll be a little more clear in my language compared to my earlier question, he did not technically shut the door in the officer's face.
Right.
But as I read the officer's testimony and watched the video, we see Sullivan entering the apartment, opening the door just enough to let himself in, and then Sullivan's pushing the door, trying to close it,
right.
And it is the officer, as he testified,
right.
Who pushed the door open.
Right.
Race doesn't come into play when we're looking at that scenario and determining whether consent exists.
Of course.
Counsel, what role does estoppel play in this case? I note in reading the August 1, 2017 response to the petition for review filed by the Wisconsin Attorney General, that they acknowledge the state failed to meet its burden. I'm reading from page 9. The state failed to meet its burden to establish by clear and positive evidence that Sullivan gave unequivocal and specific consent to enter Unit 206. And they go on to make other concessions. Likewise, in their December 12, 2017, response to petition for review. So several months later, they repeat that, hey, we, the state of Wisconsin, failed to meet our burden. And I heard comments about the reasonable person. Their position on page 9 in December of 2017 was Officer Keller's request was of a type that would not lead a normal person to believe the officer was asking for permission to enter his apartment, and there is nothing about Sullivan's actions that would lead a reasonable officer to believe that Sullivan invited in or consented to Officer Keller's entry. They continue in December of 2017. The state of Wisconsin says, Sullivan knocked, opened the door only wide enough to enter, slipped in, and attempted to push the door close, page 9. I mean, that's what you're arguing now.
Right. Yeah. I agree. I don't understand the change. In pleadings, they've essentially confessed error twice. And, you know, my opponent can address this, but, you know, staff attorneys at the frontline level in the Attorney General's office don't just wing it. This would have been, I believe, and he can correct me, this would have been improved up the chain. That was the Attorney General's position. I don't know the change, and I don't know the mechanism that allows them. I guess he's going to say they've changed their mind somehow. But I think at minimum what this really goes toward is got to remember that it requires unequivocal consent. And how can something be unequivocal when opposing counsel takes the opposite position twice, then there's some equivocation there, I think, almost by definition. There wasn't, you know, specific and unequivocal consent ever, you know, to enter Ms. Reed's apartment. But, yeah, I don't know what happened at the Attorney General's office. So I guess I want to, you know, get to the specific finding on this. You know, what the circuit court found was, and here's a quote, the actions of Mr. Sullivan in identifying people involved, when you watch the video, it's Cannon who did that, not Sullivan, informing the officers where the people were located in his mind, that was Cannon, not Sullivan, and walking to that location, leading the officers to the location, it was Keller who directed him, and Keller led until he told him to get in front, would all indicate he was freely and voluntarily, by his conduct, implying consent to enter. And so he's the circuit court here is, in essence, and I think both lower courts did this, they're attributing things to Sullivan that Cannon said. They're mashing this together. And if you focus while you're watching the video, focus on Sullivan and what Sullivan said and did, I don't think this is a close case. You know, that's the critical thing here. And I guess you know, when you watch the video, I urge you to do that.
Okay, so the takeaway for law enforcement, how would they have done this right, in your view?
He should have asked. Just ask, do you mind if I come in? Or, you know, and keep in mind, too, Keller didn't believe he had consent to enter. He was asked, did he give you permission to enter? Keller said no, he did not. This Keller went in because he said for safety and destruction of evidence, he pushed the door open. And, you know, even the circuit court in its findings didn't, again, said it, there was no imminent danger, but thought it was reasonable for him to open the door. But that's not one of the warrant exceptions. Whether it was, you know, he was uncomfortable or felt like he needed to do that, whether it was not constitutionally reasonable, but reasonable to want to do that, of course it was. I'm sure law enforcement would like to have, you know, glass doors on all the apartment buildings and have everybody walk around in, you know, with plastic bags that are see-through. But that's not how it works, you know. And so, you know, it doesn't get you in the door. You know, it has to be exigency, constitutional exigency, or constitutional consent, and neither of those things happened here. Closing the door too. You know, every other jurisdiction that's looked at this, including the cases the state cites, the act of closing the door can have no other meaning. Whatever may have been implied, and not conceding anything was implied, by closing the door, that is, you know, both literally and figuratively a terminus. And what Keller should have done, having failed to ask entry, all he could do really is knock on the door, see if he wanted to come. And his next alternative is get a warrant, if you think you have enough to get one. But I don't think there's any warrant issue here. Remember, this was an argument between two siblings over a pair of shoes. And granted, it got heated, you know, saying that, so I guess you could, you know, hammer this into disorderly conduct, but nothing came of that. No, there was no charges that came from that, even because, you know, just arguing over shoes.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
May it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Clay Kosky appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. And I have three main points this morning. Number one, this court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. Number two, Officer Stephen Keller had voluntary consent to enter Faith Reed's apartment. That consent was not withdrawn. Number three, exigent circumstances made Officer Keller's entry into Ms. Reed's apartment constitutionally reasonable. Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote for the Supreme Court in Florida versus Jimeno that, quote, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, 500 U.S. at 250.
Why is it reasonable when somebody's walking in a door and the door is closing, they open it enough to be able to get in there for the officer to just enter the house?
It is reasonable because we can't look at this in a stop-motion fashion. We have to look at the entirety of the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that the circuit court looked at in its entirety. And I want to encourage the court to at least one time watch the entire video from 0 to 9:29 without
Done.
Stopping it.
Done.
I did it, counsel.
I've watched it more than once.
And I'd like you to address what you make of the difference in Sullivan's behavior when he held the door to enter the public area of the apartment building for the officer, and then when they reached his apartment door, he tried to shut it, and the officer pushed it open. Doesn't that body language, since Sullivan was completely silent at that point and through most of the interaction, doesn't that suggest to the officer, wait a minute, okay, he was helping me get through, he held the door for me, oh, now he's shutting the door. Does that not, at a minimum, create some equivocation in our viewing of this scenario?
I think the state's position is that it does not, and here's why. Sullivan, at the door, as he's attempting to close the door but does not close it, is not actually using it as a door. He's using it more like a curtain. And he's, in fact, using his body also like a curtain to conceal the view of what's going on in the apartment. The reason I argue this is that he did three things that were quite odd. First, he told the officer that this was his own apartment, but yet he knocks on the door before he enters it. Second odd thing is he, for his own apartment again, opens the door only enough for himself to slide inside. Again, this is supposed to be his apartment. Third thing he does is he calls out Jerome. All of these things indicate that what he's trying to do is to conceal from the officer's view what is going on in the apartment and to warn...
But doesn't he have the right to conceal from the officer what's going on in the apartment?
Right, but we have to, again, turn back to reasonableness.
Yeah.
Is
counsel,
it reasonable for counsel, the officer...
Just let him finish his answer,
folks.
Can
you answer the question, please?
Let him answer.
So and your specific question was, is there a difference between opening the door, the first door? The first door, I believe, was glass. And there was no need for the officer to see anything beyond the door at that point. Obviously, Mr. Sullivan was not going to try and block the officer from seeing anything with that door. But the next door, he was, again, I'm arguing, trying to use it to conceal. Like,
but didn't he have the right? That's my question, counsel. Didn't he have the right? Didn't Sullivan have the right to conceal from the officer what was going on in his apartment?
He did have the right to do that. Yes, he did.
Thank
but
you.
That doesn't make it any less reasonable for Officer Keller to do exactly what he did.
Why? What makes it reasonable?
First of all, the state's position is that he had consent to enter the apartment. And with the consent inquiry and with the withdrawal of consent inquiry, look at it as bookends.
Let's go back. Where did the consent come from?
Specifically, the state's position is that the consent occurred, the key quote in which there was a request made to enter the apartment was, quote, "All right, let's go. Let's go over, see if he's over here. If anything, we could just all kind of talk to him." And that is in the record at 19 at minute 7:45 in the video.
Okay, but couldn't that have been interpreted by Sullivan or any reasonable person to mean, hey, let's go over to the apartment, let's see if Jerome is there, and Jerome can come out and talk to me? Why did the officer have to go into the apartment? What makes that reasonable?
In this situation, the answer to your question is no. And the reason it is reasonable to go into the apartment is because of that last part of the quote. If anything, we could just all kind of talk to him. Now, keep in mind, leading up to this, they're talking about how they believe Sullivan is in the apartment watching a football game.
No, they believe no. Isn't it? Can you distinguish specifically what Sullivan said versus what Cannon said? Sullivan said he didn't know if he was in his apartment. He might be in his apartment. He was supposed to go to his apartment.
That's correct. So I said they believed. They didn't know he was there, but they believed he was in the apartment watching a football game. Now, if he's in the apartment watching a football game, simply getting to the door and in this case, Sullivan cannot make Jerome Harris come to the door and talk to the police officer. He cannot do that. The only way that Sullivan can comply with this request to go talk to Jerome is to actually go into the apartment. Because keep in mind, Jerome Harris could be anywhere in that apartment. He could be in the bathroom. He could be in the living room.
And Sullivan could go into the apartment and say, hey, Jerome, there's an officer outside who wants to talk to you. Do you want to go out and talk to him? And then at that point, Jerome has the right to say, okay, I'll go talk to him, and leave his apartment and talk to him there. But Jerome also has the right to say no. And they have the right also to not let the officer go in at all. Do they not?
All that is correct, but it didn't happen here because Sullivan, all of his actions would lead this officer reasonably to believe that they're going into the apartment based on the entire lead up here.
And wait, what are his actions specifically? Because I watched that video, and I'm just, when we're talking about consent here, it has to be unequivocal. So tell us which of Sullivan's actions were unequivocally saying to the officer through his body language, through implied consent, please come into my apartment. I'll allow you to come into my apartment.
I want to say it. The state's position is not implied consent. It's consent by conduct. And the conduct here was that Sullivan, he started walking away when he was asked that key inquiry. And he led the officer for the next 1 minute of the video all the way to the apartment.
Wait, so your position is after watching that video, you think that Sullivan started leading the apartment? Leading Keller to the apartment and not Keller leading and then saying to Sullivan, hey, come on, get in front?
I'll say this, that there is no factual finding from the circuit court on that issue, period. There is not. And so for either side to say that it's absolutely clear.
Okay, so unequivocal. You're supposed to tell me the unequivocal facts. So that's equivocal, right? Whether he led him or he didn't lead him?
Unequivocally, Sullivan walked after being asked this question towards the apartment. That
right,
is
counsel,
unequivocal.
Counsel, I want to back you up to that question because I didn't see a question anywhere. I see at your brief, page 14, that you say after Keller said to Sullivan, all right, let's go see if he's over there, if anything, we can just talk to him. You said, viewed in context, that request would have conveyed to a reasonable person that Officer Keller was seeking consent to enter Sullivan's apartment to look for Jerome. Was there any part of that that ended with a question mark?
Well, I think that although the quote in the brief doesn't use a question mark, which is a very good point, this was a request. You look at this in light of what was just said 1.5 minutes before it, where they were talking about where Sullivan was.
But okay. So what I'm trying to figure out, though, is there's a difference between trying to figure out where the guy is versus a request to enter. Those are two different things, right? So if an officer is looking for somebody, he says, where can I find him? That's one question. And if and another might be, can I go in? That's a different request, right?
I agree. It is a different request.
Yep. All right. So I watched and listened to the video. I don't see anything with a question mark in your brief. I didn't hear anything with a question inflection in the video. So where is it that we're actually getting a question? Because if you just read it and listen to it, it's a direction. Let's go.
The state's position is that it's not a direction. It's a request.
Okay, so tell me, how do you get a request out of a declaratory direction? Tell me how that works.
Well, I think that, again, look at starting at approximately minute 6 through about 7:45 to 8. In that situation, and I want to correct something I think is not correct, Sullivan does not do any talking. Cannon is kind of a motor mouth, and he does a lot of the talking, but Sullivan does some talking. At that point, he starts indicating that he believes, that he has reason to believe that Sullivan is inside the apartment watching a football game.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole tenor of the conversation is, can we go talk to, and I said Sullivan, I meant Jerome. Jerome Harris is inside the apartment watching a football game. The entire tenor of the conversation from 6 minutes to 8 minutes of the video is the officer wants to talk to Jerome and figure out what was going on with the argument in the parking lot.
Right. But you've agreed with me that the desire to find Jerome, to talk with him, is a question separate and apart from, can I go in the apartment?
Right, and that's why I want to emphasize again the specific request that the officer made. If anything, we could just all kind of talk to him. The only way that can be accomplished in the reasonable mind of the officers by going inside the apartment, because again, Jerome Harris doesn't have to come out of the apartment.
Yeah, yeah, I know. The officer wants to go in the apartment. The question is, did he ask if he could?
The state's position is that he did, again, based on specifically
just,
that.
Okay, okay, so I just want to make sure I've got this crystal clear. So the request comes from the fact that the officer wanted to go in.
The officer specifically, again, was talking about where Jerome is. He's told he's in the apartment,
yeah.
And then he says, let's go over here. If anything, we could just all kind of talk
about. So the officer's subjective desire to enter the apartment translates in your mind into a request to go into the apartment.
I think objectively, Sullivan hearing that would translate that into he wants to go in the apartment. That's the state's position.
To any extent, does it matter whether the person knows that they're free to not consent?
And are you, Justice Ego, just to clarify, are you getting at the seizure aspect of the argument or something else?
Either, both, anything here. What,
with regard to this,
anything indicates that this person knew he could say no?
It's very important because in the analysis we're looking at what would a reasonable person think was going on in this interaction between the officer and the person who is, again, not a suspect here, just someone who is a witness to something that happened. So we have to look at, what would the officer think is reasonable? What would the person think is reasonable, given this exchange that occurred? And so we've all watched the video. The state's position is it is not debatable that everyone in that conversation thought and should have known that the request here was to go talk to Jerome in the apartment.
All right, let's do a little bit of stress test on that. So the consent was given, as you say, when the officer says, you know, let's go over there, right? That was the consent to enter. So let's fast forward now through the videotape, and instead of Sullivan opening the door, let's say he just stood there. Would the officer have been within constitutional boundaries to open the door and walk in?
Yes. So, again, and I want to emphasize that walking
forward. How do you get there?
Because the state's position is that as soon as he turned and started leading him towards the apartment, the understanding was consent through conduct to enter that apartment.
Okay, consent can be withdrawn.
It can be withdrawn.
So when you close the door on the officer, don't you think that's a pretty strong indicator?
No. Under the circumstances here, again, there are three main facts that made it not equivocal. So it was equivocal. I think this is why the circuit court made the finding that it was ambiguous. In this situation, again, the officer is led to believe by Sullivan that this is Sullivan's apartment. Yet when he gets to the door of the apartment, he knocks on the door, and that's not in dispute. And then he slips in just enough so he himself can get in, and then he calls out Jerome. Why would he be doing that if he's trying to withdraw consent? It looks equivocal in real time. And you have to keep in mind that we're talking about real time. We're not talking about stopping and starting the video over and over again, or as Ms. Reed did, having these zoom-ins.
See, I personally think your best real-time argument, and that's why I said I'm saying this to the state and to the defense, is that the officer was in fear of his own safety and thought that he needed to sort of make sure there was nothing bad going to happen.
Well, he might lose a shoe, I suppose.
It's easy to sit here on a bench in a Supreme Court in the state of Wisconsin and second-guess officers' decisions out there in the field. But you're not really arguing that today.
I am really arguing that because that's our second point is exigency.
Counsel, before you get to that
I'd like to ask a question.
Counsel, go ahead, Justice Abrahamson.
There are some issues here that are broader than this particular case. And, of course, that's one of the functions of this court is to handle that kind of issue. So one of them is, what is the effect of a state concession? And in this case, the Court of Appeals didn't accept it. What is the effect of evidence such as the cam footage that doesn't conform to the testimony given? And how do you reconcile?
I can't hear you. I don't know if counsel
I did. I think there are really two issues there. Justice Abrahamson, correct me if I'm wrong. And please let me know if you can
hear
me.
Issues there. I don't have a quota.
But I'll say the first issue I heard was, what is the effect of the state's concession?
Okay.
The second issue.
And the second one was, you've got cam footage, and it doesn't quite fit with what the testimony is about the event that is occurring on the cam footage. So these are bigger questions that transcend this particular case, although they are distinctly raised by the case. How do you deal with them?
So with regard to I'll start with the second issue because I think it goes to the standard of review. So
that's right.
In the case law, there appears to be some discrepancies on this issue, I would say. Historical facts are clearly reviewed for clear error. But when we have both a video and testimony, it gets a little murky, frankly. We have some authority that, and this is all cited in the briefs, I don't have it memorized which case they are, but I believe they're Wally and Jimmy R.R. When there's only a video, then some courts have said that we can review the video essentially de novo, even at this level. If there's a video and some testimony and it conflicts, again, we need to look at where those conflicts lie. And here, I racked my brain to figure out, are there really any conflicts between the officer's testimony and the video? State's position is that there are not. But in some cases, there might be. And so what do you do with that situation? What do you do in those two scenarios? And I'm not sure this is the right case to address that issue. I know that there are other cases perhaps in the pipeline that this court might see in the future that would directly address that issue. So I don't believe this is the case to resolve this standard of review issue. It's not necessary. All the justices have, I assume, watched the video probably multiple times. And you can't back away from the video. You have to watch the video. I want to address the issue about the state's concessions, and this is an issue that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley also raised. So Justice Ann Walsh Bradley raised the issue in terms of estoppel, and meaning judicial estoppel. The state's position is for that doctrine to apply, This court would have had to have taken the action that the state requested specifically when it previously made these concessions that don't exist, that it's not making today. So specifically, this court was asked by the state to reverse and remand to suppress the evidence. This court did not do that. It reversed for reconsideration in the Court of Appeals. So the state's position is the doctrine of judicial estoppel would not apply.
So because we remanded it to the Court of Appeals rather than the circuit court, the judicial estoppel is not met. Is that your position?
Correct. And I want to address also why the state, is now in a different position.
Okay. Let me be, as part of that answer, perhaps, I see this as quintessentially a burden of proof. And the state has the burden of proof, as you said in August of 2017, the burden to establish by clear and positive evidence that Sullivan gave unequivocal and specific consent to enter Unit 206. So you've got the burden to show by clear and positive evidence of unequivocal and specific consent. I really find it difficult, since I've highlighted in August all of the parts of your presentation to the court, as an officer of the court, this is true. In December, your presentation to the court, and when I say you, I mean the office of the Attorney General.
I stand
General.
Here for the office.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got it highlighted. You are in direct lockstep with defense here. And now you come here and change your opinion. Maybe you're not judicially estopped. Maybe you are. But how can you argue, and it's okay to change your mind, people change their minds, but in the face of your burden to show, as you say, by direct, clear and positive evidence that Sullivan gave unequivocal and specific consent to enter, your change of attitude after twice taking a different position and now altering that just, I think, undermines in my mind any credibility of your argument that you have met this burden. I mean, reasonable minds can differ, but you have this burden.
I think that one key thing changed that the state feels justifies such a change in position.
And therefore meets its burden.
Okay, well, let him answer.
Correct.
Listen,
and that is that this court decided to accept,
I want to hear
accept the case.
Answer.
I'm sorry, I just.
Please,
I want to
go
make
ahead.
Sure I
arguing among ourselves, I'm just interested in what you're going to say.
One thing that happened that changed was that this court decided to take the case. And it decided to take the case for full briefing and argument. And it would do everyone of the state a great disservice to have this case presented by only one side. There's an institutional interest of the state and of this court, which is a lawmaking, policymaking body in this situation. It's going to potentially create a new rule for the whole state. There is an interest of the state.
Are you telling the truth here, or are you telling the truth now?
I'm telling the truth right now.
Okay, and so the truth before, as you advanced it, still, how does that fit in when you have two different truths? How does that fit into your burden? Because for me, this is a burden case.
Again, the burden, if the court's looking at the evidence, the state, we're looking at what the state did at the circuit court. It presented the testimony of Officer Keller. It presented the video. Do those things meet the state's burden? That's what it did, and it made its argument before the circuit court. Did those things meet the state's burden? That's what this court needs to analyze. And I want to go back to and finish my thought.
Yes.
This court is setting policy for the state, and the state has an interest in seeing that there's a fulsome and vigorous presentation of both sides of the argument. That's why we're here today arguing as we are. That's why I'm here. I'm taking vigorous positions that I believe in. And I believe that probably the strongest thing I want to go back to is the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. Was it reasonable for Officer Keller to do what he did in this case? Look at the whole 9 minutes and 29 seconds. It was reasonable.
And Counselor, on that, I'm glad you turned back to that. There are just a couple of details I'd like to finish up with here. Do you agree with Mr. Reed's counsel that Mr. Reed was seized when Officer Keller told him, "Hey, why don't you come back here? Don't just leave."
And you mean Mr. Sullivan? But the state does not agree that Mr. Sullivan was seized. So number one, the state's position is he is not seized. Look at where that interaction occurred in the discussion. It was, again, 45 seconds in. Mr. Cannon is kind of a motor mouth. He's doing all the talking, giving the officer all the information. Sullivan, you can tell in the video, perhaps, we don't know, but perhaps feels kind of left out of the conversation and starts to walk away. He gets about 15 paces away. That's what everyone kind of agrees. You can see it in the video when officer calls out to him. The officer calls out to him in a loud voice because he's far away. And so then he comes back. And so there are two main issues here. The calling out to come back, which he does, comes back, and then take the hands out of the pockets. I think that Ms. Reed, in her brief, in her reply brief, is trying to emphasize a case called Griffin from the Eastern District where that person was ordered to keep his hands in the air and that was a seizure.
Okay, so...
That is not what happened.
All right, so help me out with this. So when Mr. Sullivan walks away, Officer Keller tells him to come back. How is Mr. Sullivan to distinguish between an officer suggesting that he comes back and ordering him to come back?
Well, we have to look at the circumstances here again. He'd only been interacting with the officer for maybe 45 seconds. In the video, it occurs about 1:15.
Okay.
So, again, Cannon's doing all the talking. Sullivan isn't really engaging with the officer. And the state's position is that under these circumstances, he wasn't seized. And I want to emphasize...
Now, Officer Keller thought that he seized him.
That's correct. He did testify to that at the suppression hearing. And so we have to look at it, again, objectively reasonable.
Right. It's an objective standard. But, you know, if an officer says that he seized him, I don't know. That's a fairly good indication of how we ought to look at this, right?
Well, that's true. But we have a finding from the circuit court that it's obvious that he wasn't ordered to return.
Yeah, but the finding from the circuit court is based on that he hadn't been accused of having done anything wrong. And that has nothing to do with whether you've been seized for a Terry stop, right?
That's right. I want to emphasize a few more points, though, with regard to this idea of seizure and looking at the whole totality. If you look at the video, there's a point in which the officer says, "Could you all just stay here until we figure this out?" And that's a little bit further along in the video. I think it's at 4:45 or 6. I don't recall exactly. But in any event, the officer at that point is engaging and saying, you know, "Would you mind sticking around?"
No.
It's not looking like a seizure at that point.
All right. So help me out here and help out the rest of the people of the state of Wisconsin in their interactions with our good police officers. How were they objectively to determine when an officer says, "Don't just leave," that they can say, "Thanks, I'm leaving anyway," without being escorted to the pavement?
I disagree with the characterization that he'd be escorted to the pavement in that situation.
Oh, I know. But the point is, how is the average Wisconsin citizen supposed to understand that when an officer says, "Don't just leave," he doesn't actually mean that?
Well, I think you have to look at the situation. Here, the officer wasn't really interacting with Sullivan at that point. So you have to look at it from Sullivan's perspective. That's the only way we can do this in this particular scenario. Other scenarios that might occur out in public for the average citizen might be different. That person might have never interacted with a police officer before. Obviously, Mr. Sullivan had. He was on parole for a battery, strangulation and suffocation.
So let's set that point aside and assume for the purpose of this next question that he was seized. Does the fact of the seizure color how we look at Mr. Sullivan's conduct from that point forward in determining whether he was giving consent?
It certainly colors it. It's part of the totality of circumstances that you must do in the objective reasonableness inquiry. It absolutely is part of something the court needs to look at.
Okay, so if... is it required for your position that there was consent? Is it necessary that he was not seized?
No, it is not.
So even if he was seized, you would say his conduct still evinced consent to enter the apartment?
Yes.
And that conduct was when the officer said, "Okay, let's go," and they started walking. That was the point at which unequivocal consent was given.
That's correct.
Okay. And so that'd be true even if he was seized at that moment.
That's correct, yes. Even if he was seized. And I want to emphasize again, so that's the 7-minute, 45-second mark in the video is a key point to the state. But beyond that, the next minute, Mr. Sullivan's conduct throughout everything he did up to that point where he ambiguously or equivocally did some actions at the door, everything up to that point continued to reaffirm consent, consent, consent. He has to unequivocally withdraw the consent, and he did not do that at the door.
Can I take you then, counsel, to the exigency? If you look at the video and the door is closed, isn't it, how do you distinguish between exigency that is caused by the officer in opening the door potentially versus the fact if you actually watch the video and see the door closing, the officer can't see anything happening in that apartment until he actually puts his hand in the door. So do you understand what I'm asking? I know I'm not being really clear, but the argument you're making for exigency is he sees the individual Sullivan try to shield his body. He thinks something's going on there. He's worried what it is. But isn't it true that he can't see anything until he actually puts his hand in the door to push it open? That there's a split second when that door is closing in his face that he really can't see what's going on in that apartment? And is exigency just wanting to know if there's some gun or wanting to know if there's some drugs?
I think the point you're making is really hits the nail on the head exactly, and it emphasizes what Justice Ziegler was saying, which is it's that split second. The officer has to react in that split second. What is he supposed to do to protect himself?
Well, why does he have to? He wouldn't have seen it had he not put his hand in the door. He wouldn't have seen anything. He would have just had a door close in his face, right? So where's the exigency if he's standing in the hall and the guy has gone in, Sullivan has gone in, closed the door? What are we worried about here? We know that he's got the one guy has a warrant for driving without a license. He got in a fight over some shoes. What is the exigency here?
Well, there's a lot more going on in the officer's mind. The officer is alone. The next officer doesn't show up for another 35 seconds. So the officer is alone. He knows that there are three people in the apartment once Sullivan gets in there because he just told outside that Reed is there and that Jerome is likely there. So the officer is going to be in a 3-on-1 situation. And so he has to make a split-second decision when this man in front of him is behaving in an odd way, knocking again on his own door, sliding, opening only at the
closing the door behind him.
And then calling out Jerome. Who knows why he's calling out Jerome? He could be calling out Jerome for Jerome to go hide, try and escape, conceal something. The officer has to decide in that moment what to do.
But the officer could be imagining these things no matter whose door he's going to. And the fact that the officer goes to the front door of somebody's apartment or house means that if he has a suspicion or a bad feeling that there might be a gun behind the door, he gets to come in?
Well, I think that imagining is something that is an interesting phraseology in this situation because we need to look at objectively what's going on in the reasonable officer's mind. Objectively, let me see, my light is on. May I finish the answer?
You can finish your sentence.
Objectively, this officer, in that split second, we're talking about, you look at that part of the video, it's 10 seconds or less. He's got to decide what to do in that scenario, and it was reasonable for him to do exactly what he did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. 2 years ago yesterday, there was an argument in this court in another consent or home entry case, Weber. And in one of the dissents, Rebecca Bradley's dissent, she quoted Boyd versus the United States, sort of block quote, saying, illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing by silent approaches and
counsel,
deviations.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're not audible unless you speak directly into the microphone.
Okay, I'll talk louder.
In a top voice.
Yep.
Thank you.
Illegitimate and unconstitutional practices get their first footing by silent approaches and slight deviations from legal modes of procedure. This can only be obviated by adhering to the rule that constitutional provisions for security of person and property should be liberally construed. It's the duty of the courts to be watchful for the constitutional rights of the citizen and against any stealthy encroachments. And here, this isn't a stealthy encroachment. It's literally walking in through the front door. Turning to the issues that some of the issues he raised, there's no discrepancy between the testimony here and the video. There's some discrepancy between findings, but most of those findings are conclusions of law. Like, was he seized? Is the facts aren't in dispute. Whether or not he was seized, those facts constitute a seizure is a question of law, which you review de novo. There's no implied consent case or no consent case, period, that I could find where there wasn't a clear, overt ask. You know, when there's a clear ask, may I come in, the implied consent cases then immediately follow up with some sort of gesture, opening a door, stepping away.
Counsel, I'd like to give you another item to think about.
Sure.
If you would assume, though I know you don't take this position, that the officer had consent to go into Sullivan's apartment to talk with Jerome if Jerome was there. Is the partial closing of the door, as shown on a video that we all have watched, unequivocal withdrawal of that consent?
Yes, and a host of other cases nationwide say so.
Well,
yep.
All right.
Why?
Okay.
Because he's been invited in, and when he's at the threshold, the door is closed in his face. That reasonably, I think, to anybody would say that whatever permission I had is gone. It's not permission in perpetuity. And look, I'll give you this example.
How is it unequivocal? Because I think the circuit court found that the closing of the door was equivocal.
No, absolutely not.
It not.
The
okay.
circuit court did not. What the circuit okay. court said is it is not clear to me who closed the door. And because it was not clear to me who closed the door, I don't give it the same interpretation you do. Circuit court.
So you think the circuit court was wrong because it's clear from the video that it was Sullivan who partially closed
correct.
The door.
Correct. That is the factual error I think we agree on, and so did the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
It didn't say that closing a door can't mean anything else. That's what it means. It's a terminus.
I think if he'd shut it all away and you'd heard the click of the door, I think we probably all wouldn't be here today. So I think the fact that the door wasn't tightly shut when he went in is what causes us all to have this argument.
Well, but he entered with a closing door. The door would have closed. He stopped it by his unlawful entry.
Well, you don't know that, and I don't know that, and you can't tell that from the video. I mean, my door on my house doesn't close until I push it shut.
Yeah, and Sullivan's hand was on the door closing it.
So, counsel, isn't it an unequivocal, if there had been consent, this would constitute an unequivocal withdrawal of consent because he placed the door in a position where it was impossible for Officer Keller to enter?
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the Court of Appeals went up this kind of weird tangent that it somehow just delays entry. I mean, door's a door. And I guess, you know, I would offer an example of Justice Rogensack of take the police out of this. So one, somebody's coming, I'm in my yard working, and somebody comes, one of the fundraisers, and says, you know, is my wife home because she's contributed and it's I don't know, she's inside watching a football game. I don't know. Although that wouldn't happen. It would be Tour de France or biathlon. And so it says, well, let's go see. I walk with the person
sure.
to my door. I yep. go to my door. I close the door behind me. Is it reasonable to think that that person would just then follow me? And of course not. They would wait outside, waiting to see if she wants to come. And that's all Officer Keller had here. That is all that happened. Nobody would feel, at least no stranger, I think, would feel, if they were friends, maybe you'd come in because you got sort of implied, you know, guest thing. But
yeah.
no stranger would feel like they can just walk into a closing door under, you know, even when you take the cops out of the scenario.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a good answer to my question. And thank you all for very spirited arguments. I'm sorry sometimes you didn't get to talk because the court was so engaged. But you can see you have a court that has seen the video, read the briefs, and is thoroughly considering the arguments made on both sides of this very important issue. So thank you very much for excellent briefs and really quite a fun argument. So we're going to adjourn for a little bit now so we can set up for the next oral argument. We are adjourned.